Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for tuning in, and welcome back. Today we will explore the origin of our moon with Dr. Dana McKenzie. Dana received a PhD in mathematics from Princeton and taught at Duke and Kenyon College. Later, he attended the Science Communications Program at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and is now a science writer. He's appeared on the History Channel and writes for many major scientific magazines. He's also the author of four books, including The Big Splat, or How Our Moon Came to Be. Dana, welcome to our show.
I'm doing great, Robert, and how are you doing?
Fine, thanks. So, Dana, you wrote this great book, which I love the title. It's called The Big Splat, or How the Moon Came to Be. So right. This really tells us about the origin of the moon, does it?
That's correct. So this is a book that I wrote, came out a few years ago in 2003. It's really the first book that explains the contemporary scientific consensus on the origin of the moon.
How did you come to be interested in the topic and to understand what the current contemporary thinking was?
By profession, I'm a science journalist, and so one of the things I like to do is go to various meetings and try to find stories that would be interesting to write about for the various magazines I write for. So it happened that in 1998, I went to a meeting called the Conference on the Origin of the Earth and Moon that was held in Monterey, California. It was a gathering of about 100 to 150 lunar scientists, and I heard over and over references to a particular theory of the moon's origin. I'll keep you in suspense as to what that theory is for the moment, but what really surprised me was the unanimity of the scientists who were there. I'd say about two-thirds of them believed this theory, and the other third maybe were still agnostic, but they certainly didn't believe any other theories. So this is what I would call the default theory of the moon's origin. So it really is a consensus that has come about. And what struck me was that as a layperson, I had never heard of this theory. And here we spent $25 billion on the Apollo missions to go to the moon. And, of course, there were many reasons we went to the moon. But the number one scientific reason, the top item on the scientific agenda, was to find out where the moon came from. So we spent all this money to go to the moon. We've answered the main question we went to answer, and yet no one had ever communicated this fact to the public. And so I said, wow, now this is a story that really needs to be told. And that really was the motivation and the origin behind my book, The Big Splat.
So, Dana, people must have been thinking about the origin of the moon for quite a long time. And I've heard that there were several previous theories about how the moon might have come to be. And perhaps you could describe what those ideas were and what made sense about them and ultimately what didn't make sense about them.
Well, and that's actually a lot of what I write about in my book, The Big Splat, not just the current theory, but the previous theories as well. And before we went to the moon, there were basically three contending theories for how the moon got there. These are known as the fission theory, the co-accretion theory, and the capture theory. Or perhaps we should use the word hypothesis rather than theory, because these are, you know, no one really had any proof for any of them at that point.
Yeah, but we call it string theory, and there's no proof
that
either.
Yeah. Right. So anyway, back before we went to the moon, we had three hypotheses, none with any very good proof. So the first was the fission hypothesis. This was proposed by a very interesting fellow named George Darwin. Now, does that name ring any bells to you?
I thought the name was Charles.
That's right. Well, this was Charles Darwin's son, who is now, of course, you know, kind of forgotten. But in his day, he was actually one of the leading scientists in England. George Darwin was interested in tides, And one of the things he discovered was that there's the tidal effect of the moon on the Earth is tending to do two things at once. It tends to slow the Earth's rotation down, and it makes the moon move farther and farther away from Earth. And 90 years later, we went to the moon, and in fact, we discovered that he was right. So the moon is moving away from Earth. It's moving at a rate of about 1.5 centimeters a year.
Hmm.
So, interesting fact. And also, Earth's rotation is also slowing down, like George Darwin said.
There are going to be more hours in the day for us in the future.
So Darwin correctly figured out that there is this process of tidal friction that's making the moon move away from Earth. And he said, okay, wait a minute. What if I go backwards in time? You know, if the moon is moving away from Earth, that means it was closer to Earth in the past. And so if you go back to the beginning, maybe the moon came from Earth. And so that was his theory called the fission theory. So he believes that the Earth had been spinning so rapidly back in the beginning that it had actually thrown off a big glob of molten material, and that glob was subsequently turned into the moon.
Hmm.
But unfortunately, that theory really doesn't hold water very well from the point of view of physics, because it is actually very hard to get the Earth to spin fast enough to just throw off this glob of material, how this might have happened.
So the numbers didn't work out. What came next?
Next was the capture hypothesis. This was particularly advocated by Thomas Jefferson Jackson See. One of the good things he did was come up with this idea and actually do some of the mathematical calculations for how the moon might have been captured by Earth. So he thought that the moon arose somewhere else in the solar system, you know, maybe the outer solar system, and wandered too close to Earth's orbit, and was captured by Earth. Now, this is not a completely outrageous idea. In fact, Mars has two moons, Phobos and Deimos, which almost certainly are captured. They're probably captured from the asteroid belt. But those moons are much, much smaller than our moon. Okay, so they're just kind of big rocks. But our moon is by far the biggest moon compared to its host planet of any moon in the solar system. So we have this gigantic moon. It's 1/4 the diameter of Earth. It's 1/80 the mass of Earth. So the question is, how can you capture something that is so huge? And once again, it's very difficult to do that. And in order to explain that, C had to assume that there was some what he called a resisting medium. So he believed that the vacuum of space was not a vacuum. And, well, now we've been to space, and we know he was wrong. The vacuum of space really is a vacuum. And so there's still a question then of how on Earth could you slow this thing down enough that the Earth's gravity could capture it. And so that's really a big problem with the capture theory.
Mm-hmm.
Then the third hypothesis was the co-accretion hypothesis. And this just says, okay, the planets form out of a bunch of debris that was orbiting the sun shortly after the sun formed, and these are called planetesimals. And basically these planetesimals bang into each other and they clump together, and the clumps get bigger and bigger, and eventually they form planets. And what happened was just that the moon grew up at the same time as Earth did. And so basically the moon was always there. It just grew up in the same place as us out of these sort of little planetesimals. So those were the three theories we had before Apollo went to the moon: the co-accretion, the capture, and the fission hypotheses. And what's fascinating is that after the Apollo missions, none of these theories or none of these hypotheses really worked anymore. So the trouble with the fission hypothesis, well, I said already, it was implausible physically. It was very difficult to get the Earth to throw off this giant body. The other two hypotheses were really disproved by the lunar samples that we brought back. So the thing about the capture hypothesis is that if the moon came from somewhere else in the solar system, it should be very different compositionally from the Earth. So you should have different proportions of various elements, and particularly you should have different isotopes. Oxygen has two forms, oxygen-16 and oxygen-18, and you have very different proportions of those depending on where you are in the solar system. And when we brought back the moon rocks, we saw that they looked identical. The isotope ratios were identical to Earth. And so this suggests that the moon rocks were forming either near Earth or even in Earth, maybe like the fission theory said. But this doesn't look very good for the capture theory. The moon could not have formed very far away. On the other hand, the co-accretion theory had some problems too, because there are some big differences between the moon and the Earth, and differences that are hard to explain if the moon and Earth grew up at the same time. So first of all, the moon has very much less iron than Earth. The moon is much less dense than Earth is. Earth has a huge iron core. A third of our planet is iron. By contrast, basically the moon is rock almost all the way down. And so there's this huge disparity between the moon and Earth. Why did the Earth get all of the iron and the moon didn't get any? Doesn't make sense if they both grew up in the same place out of the same materials. Another difference, the moon has almost no volatiles, or have much lower concentrations on the moon. Why is that? You know, again, if we had co-accretion, the moon should have the same amounts of these things. So all of these things didn't add up. The co-accretion theory didn't work either. And so we had three hypotheses, and none of them fit the samples that we brought back from the moon.
Hmm.
So for a decade after we got back from the moon, this question was still like in limbo. No one really could explain why, you know, where the moon came from or why these theories didn't work.
You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and we are talking today about the origin of the moon with Dr. Dana McKenzie. This month, we're having another book drawing, so go to our website, guidetothecosmos.com, email us your questions and suggestions for future show topics, and you'll be entered into a drawing for a free copy of my second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? We'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's guidetothecosmos.com.
We're back, talking about the origin of the moon with Dr. Dana McKenzie. So Dana, if these three hypotheses have sort of failed us, what are we left with now as the alternative?
So the alternative is what's called the giant impact hypothesis. And this is, of course, what I wrote about in the book, and it's what gave the name to the book, The Big Splat. So the giant impact hypothesis says that Earth was hit early in its formation by another planet the size of Mars. So this would be a planet about one-tenth the mass of Earth. And this impact destroyed the impacting planet, also blew off a lot of Earth's mantle into orbit around Earth. So for a brief period, maybe of a year or so, maybe 100 years, Earth actually had rings like Saturn did, just from the debris of this planet, this impactor, and Earth's own mantle. But these rings, unlike Saturn's rings, were not stable because they were far too dense. And so very quickly, the material in these rings started to coalesce. And eventually, the sort of biggest lump in this ring, in these rings coalesced to form the moon. And all the other little lumps were sucked in either by the moon or else they fell back to Earth. So the moon was formed as a result of this giant impact between Earth and a Mars-sized planet, which we now call Theia.
So Dana, when is this impact thought to have occurred?
So this impact happened in the very early solar system. And this is something I really want to emphasize, because you might wonder if something like that could happen today, and could planets collide and so forth? Well, no. Okay, our planets have been stable for billions of years. So the solar system is about 4.5 billion years old, and for essentially all of that time, we've had the nine planets, or eight planets now that Pluto's not official anymore. We've had eight planets going around the sun and not colliding with each other. But in the very, very early stages of the solar system, the first 50 to 100 million years, so remember we're now talking millions, not billions, so the first 50 million years or so, the planets were forming out of this disk of debris and planetesimals that were orbiting around the sun. Earth was accreting, just like all the other planets, out of these planetesimals. And another planet the size of Mars also was accreting, maybe not in Earth's orbit, but nearby. And that this was not a stable configuration. You could not really fit two planets within this small region of space. And so eventually the two of them had to collide. And they did so roughly 50 million years after the solar system started to form.
Okay, so you're saying that planets can't be too close together, or right, they interfere with each other's orbits.
That's exactly right.
The orbits won't be stable, and eventually something's got to give.
That's right.
And in this particular case, what happened was these two planets that were, the other planet was 10% the size of Earth, but that's still
right,
pretty massive.
Yep.
So they disturbed each other, and this planet, Theia, eventually collided with Earth and created this cataclysm.
That's right, yep.
And this was all within the first, essentially, 1% of the life of the solar system. So that collision must have been absolutely catastrophic.
It's unbelievable. One of the people who's done computer simulations of this giant impact is Robin Knupp, who's at the Southwest Research Institute in Colorado.
I want to break in for a moment to let you know that we received permission from Dr. Robin Knupp to show you her video simulation of the collision of the planet Theia with Earth. So go to my website, guidetothecosmos.com, click on the radio microphone icon, and there you'll be able to access a copy of this video. Now let's continue talking to Dana.
What you'll see is this impactor coming along and hitting the Earth at an oblique angle. Now, that's essential, because if the impactor had hit the Earth straight on, then it would blow lots of material up into the air, but it'd all come back down again. But with this oblique impact, you get a lot of material thrown out into orbit around Earth. Now, the big question was still, how does that material stay out there? Why doesn't it fall down again? And there are a couple things going on here. First of all is that there's a lot of gas and volatiles released by this impact. This incidentally explains why the moon has no volatiles, because the things that were easily vaporized just went right out into space and did not go into the moon rocks. And this explosion of gas and stuff would have propelled material into orbit around the Earth, just like a rocket fuel propels a rocket into orbit as well. Then the second effect, which you can see very nicely in Robin's illustration, is you can start seeing these kind of spiral arms forming, spiral arms of debris. And she found that actually these arms work like a gravitational siphon that pulls stuff up into orbit. She uses the word gravitational torque. So it doesn't just go up and come down. It goes up and then stays up and forms a ring system around Earth. So the animation that you see here is just the first day after the lunar impact. And you can see at the end of the day that you have this wide field of debris around the Earth, and you have sort of spiral arms within that field. And those spiral arms are where the material starts coalescing and eventually coalescing into the moon.
And how close to the Earth do you think the moon was when it first formed?
There's some interesting physical constraints on that. So if the moon had formed closer than about 2.8 Earth radii, any body that formed would be torn apart. So the moon had to form at least, roughly 3 Earth radii away, but probably not a lot farther than that, because the material was coming from Earth. So when the moon formed, it was very close to Earth. It was maybe, 4 Earth radii away. By comparison, today the moon is 60 Earth radii away. So the moon would have been 15 times closer to Earth. And so if you can imagine what this would look like, has the moon up there in the sky 15 times bigger than it is today. And it'd be this giant red ball in the sky because, you know, from the heat of this impact, all of the material that formed the moon was, you know, was crashing into each other and coalescing to form the moon. So it would have been very, very hot. And so the moon would have been glowing red in the sky. So it's I think, fascinating to think about what this thing would have looked like. One of the strong arguments in favor of this impact scenario is that we now know that the moon was covered by an ocean of magma early in its history. That was one of the great discoveries of the Apollo missions, which, again, I don't think really got, the public didn't really get told this story very clearly, but we've discovered rocks on the moon that called anorthosite that typically float at the top of a pool of magma. And we've also found some fascinating rocks that are little bitty glass beads. So it looked to the astronauts like actually green soil. So the Apollo 15 astronauts discovered this green soil on the moon. And then the Apollo 17 astronauts discovered what they looked to them like orange soil. Well, it turns out that they're little bitty volcanic glass beads that were erupted from deep in the moon's interior. These beads contain the relics of this magma ocean. And so we've not only got samples from the top of the ocean that the Apollo astronauts connected, these anorthosites, we also have these glass beads that came from the bottom of the ocean. And so it's a marvelous story of scientific discovery, which I think has been virtually untold. And so that is, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to write my book.
Mm-hmm. And hasn't the moon been very important in the development of Earth and particularly life on Earth?
Sure. It's interesting to think about what life on Earth, if there was life, would be like without the moon. One of the most important effects that the moon has on Earth is that it stabilizes our rotation axis so that we do not, our rotation axis does not flip around as much as, for example, Mars does. So Mars has had much bigger changes in climate over its history because its rotation axis is not as stable. And so it looks as if Mars, early in its history, had liquid water flowing on the planet, and now, you know, that now it's a completely frozen planet. So whereas Earth has, you know, we've had ice ages, and we've had periods of heat and periods of cold, but we've had not had as significant swings as Mars, and so this has made Earth more hospitable to life.
Has anyone estimated how rare this sort of event would be in an average solar system?
That's a great question, you know, and actually, I think this is an important question to ask from the point of view of why do we believe this theory now? Because when the theory was first proposed, proposed in 1974 by two people who I think are both geniuses. One is Bill Hartman, and the other was Alistair Cameron. Incidentally, for quite different reasons, they came at this theory like from completely different directions, but they both came up with the idea at the same time. The reception at first was, I'd say, you got to be kidding. You know, scientists did not want to believe this sort of theory, because back in the 60s and the 70s, you know, the assumption was that the solar system was a nice, stable place. Nothing violent collisions never happened in the solar system. Well, we now know that's not true. We know the early system was a much more chaotic place. And, of course, we also know things like that there, you know, there have been impacts on Earth throughout our history that have affected our history. So, for example, the meteorite impact that is credited with killing the dinosaurs, you know, that theory came along in 1980. The realization that things like that have happened in Earth's history made scientists more willing to take seriously the idea of that we were actually hit by another planet. Because if you believe we were hit by meteorites that were 10 kilometers in diameter and 100 kilometers in diameter, then you have to imagine that there were ones that hit us that were 1,000 kilometers in diameter. And, you know, at some point in our history, it's actually likely that something like that would happen. And in fact, we see, once you're looking for it, you can see signs of this sort of impact everywhere in the solar system.
But it also had to impact in a specific way.
Yeah, right, exactly. So almost every planet has a giant impact, but they happen in different ways. So Uranus, the planet beyond Saturn, tipped over on its side. Its axis is 90 degrees from where most of the other planetary axes are. Mm-hmm. Why? Probably because something ran into it and tipped its axis over.
But none of the other planets have a moon like our moon, as you...
Right, none except Pluto. Okay, so Pluto might have also had its own sort of smaller, you know, its own pretty big impact.
Mm-hmm.
It has a moon called Charon that's pretty big also compared to it. But none of the other planets have these big moons, so they didn't have a giant impact in exactly the same way. They probably did not have an oblique impact like we did. Mercury probably had an impact. Mercury has a very small mantle compared to the other planets. It's mostly core. And so it probably had an impact that blew all its mantle out into space.
Mm.
So every planet has an impact, but it does different things. And it's sort of this, so it's like this giant lottery as to what kind of impact you have and what it does to your planet. Does it tip you over on its side? Does it blow your mantle off into space? Does it slow you down? And actually, Venus rotates in the opposite direction from the other planets, so, you know, so it probably had a retrograde impact. So fascinating realization, you know, about the way our solar system works. No one had any idea of this before we went to the moon. And so by going to the moon and by eventually finding the evidence for this giant impact theory, we've actually revolutionized our understanding of the entire solar system.
Well, that's really remarkable.
Yeah, so anybody who thinks that it's a waste of time to go to the moon, I hope they're listening to this and realize that at least from the scientific viewpoint, we just got an unbelievable payoff. And I'm sure if we go back, there will be other incredible payoffs.
Do we know anything about this Theia planet that
hit Earth? Well, I think that's a really fun thing to think about. One theory that was actually proposed after my book came out is that Theia actually formed at what's called a Lagrange point.
Mm-hmm.
So there are two points on Earth in Earth's orbit where you can actually put something and have it be stay there for a long period of time without being jostled. And so Theia could actually have grown up near one of these Lagrange points and stayed there for 50 million years. And then you ask, well, why didn't it stay there forever? Well, the answer to that is Jupiter. So Jupiter is this gigantic planet that really rules everything in our solar system. And basically, every time that Jupiter's orbit brings it closer, you know, sort of at its closest approach to Earth and to Theia, it would have tugged Theia a little bit. And then the next time it passed around, it would tug Theia again until eventually it moved away from this stable Lagrange point, and then at that point it was doomed to hit Earth.
Hmm.
So what would it have been like if we didn't have Jupiter? Maybe Theia would have stayed there, and we would now have, instead of having a moon, we would have this Mars-sized planet that was in our own orbit, but either 2 months ahead of us or 2 months behind us in the orbit. And so we would have this constant, you know, light in the sky that sort of followed around through the constellations through the year. It would be an amazingly different scenario, and I'd love to see, you know, some science fiction writer take that on.
Well, you could write a science fiction book yourself.
Yeah, maybe I
should.
Branch out.
You know,
a new career.
Really
should. Yeah. I'd call it Earth Junior.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much, Dana, for enlightening us about the moon.
You know, one of the things I loved about writing a book about the moon, just that it's so visible. You know, so many things in science that you read about, they're so far away, or they're so microscopic, you can't see them. But the moon is out there every night. You know, when I was writing my book, I'd go out there and I'd say, yeah, that's what I'm writing about. That's my moon out there. And, you know, I hope that all of your listeners can sort of have the same feeling towards it. Because as we now know, the moon is sort of a piece of our Earth. It's a piece that was blown off by this giant impact.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really ours.
So you have a website that's dedicated to the moon. It's www.danamackenzie.com/moon.
Right.
And if the listeners didn't happen to write that down, they can go to my website, and there'll be a link on the website that takes them right there. So, Dana, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
And well, thank you, Robert. I've really enjoyed it.
So I want to thank you for joining us today and remind you, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guide to the cosmos.com. Goodbye.